education, just as he had his. For the last 2 years, Lailo had received the Awwal Numra certificate, given yearly to the top-ranked student in each grade. She said nothing of these things to Hasina, though, whose own father was an ill-tempered taxi driver who in 2 or 3 years would almost certainly give her away. Hasina had told Lailo, in one of her infrequent serious moments, that it had already been decided that she would marry a first cousin who was 20 years older than her and owned an auto shop in Lahore. "I've seen him twice," Hasina had said. "Both times he ate with his mouth open." "Beans, girls," Hasina said. "You remember that, unless, of course..." Here she flashed an impish grin and nudged Lailo with an elbow. "It's your young, handsome, one-legged prince who comes knocking. Then..." Lailo slapped the elbow away. She would have taken offense if anyone else had said that about Tariq. But she knew that Hasina wasn't malicious. She mocked. It was what she did. And her mocking spared no one, least of all herself. "You shouldn't talk that way about people," Giti said. "What people is that?" "People who've been injured because of war," Giti said earnestly, oblivious to Hasina's toying. "I think Mullah Giti here has a crush on Tariq." "I knew it, ha!" "But he's already spoken for, don't you know? Isn't he, Lailo?"
"I do not have a crush on anyone."
They broke off from Lailo and, still arguing this way, turned into their street. Lailo walked alone the last 3 blocks. When she was on her street, she noticed that the blue Benz was still parked there, outside Rashid and Mariam's house. The elderly man in the brown suit was standing by the hood now, leaning on a cane, looking up at the house. That was when a voice behind Lailo said, "Hey, yellow hair, look here." Lailo turned around and was greeted by the barrel of a gun. The gun was red, the trigger guard bright green. Behind the gun loomed Khadim's grinning face. Khadim was 11, like Tariq. He was thick, tall, and had a severe underbite. His father was a butcher in Demazang, and from time to time, Khadim was known to fling bits of calf intestine at passers-by. Sometimes, if Tariq wasn't nearby, Khadim shadowed Lailo in the schoolyard at recess, leering, making little whining noises. One time, he tapped her on the shoulder and said, "You're so very pretty, yellow hair. I want to marry you." Now he waved the gun. "Don't worry," he said. "This won't show, not on your hair." "Don't you do it. I'm warning you." "What are you going to do?" he said. "Sick your cripple on me?" "Oh, Tariq John. Oh, won't you come home and save me from the bad mosh?" Lailo began to backpedal, but Khadim was already pumping the trigger. One after another, thin jets of warm water struck Lailo's hair, then her palm when she raised it to shield her face. Now the other boys came out of their hiding, laughing, cackling. An insult Lailo had heard on the street rose to her lips. She didn't really understand it, couldn't quite picture the logistics of it, but the words packed a fierce potency, and she unleashed them now. "Your mother eats cock." "At least she's not a loony like yours," Khadim shot back, unruffled. "At least my father is not a sissy. And, by the way, why don't you smell your hands?" The other boys took up the chant. "Smell your hands, smell your hands." Lailo did. But she knew even before she did what he'd meant about it not showing in her hair. She let out a high-pitched yelp. At this, the boys hooted even harder. Lailo turned around and, howling, ran home. She drew water from the well and in the bathroom filled a basin, tore off her clothes. She soaped her hair, frantically digging fingers into her scalp, whimpering with disgust. She rinsed with a bowl and soaped her hair again. Several times, she thought she might throw up. She kept mewling and shivering as she rubbed and rubbed the soapy washcloth against her face and neck until they reddened. This would have never happened if Tariq had been with her, she thought as she put on a clean shirt and fresh trousers. Khadim wouldn't have dared. Of course, it wouldn't have happened if Mami had shown up like she was supposed to, either. Sometimes Laila wondered why Mami had even bothered having her. People, she believed now, shouldn't be allowed to have new children if they'd already given away all their love to their old ones. It wasn't fair. A fit of anger claimed her. Laila went to her room, collapsed on her bed. When the worst of it had passed, she went across the hallway to Mami's door and knocked. When she was younger, Laila used to sit for hours outside this door. She would tap on it and whisper Mami's name over and over, like a magic chant meant to break a spell. Mami, 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 Mami. But Mami never opened the door. She didn't open it now. Laila turned the knob and walked in. Sometimes Mami had good days. She sprang out of bed, bright-eyed and playful. The droopy lower lip stretched upward in a smile. She bathed. She put on fresh clothes and wore mascara. She let Laila brush her hair, which Laila loved doing, and pin earrings through her earlobes. They went shopping together to Mandai Bazaar. Laila got her to play snakes and ladders, and they ate shavings from blocks of dark chocolate, one of the few things they shared a common taste for. Laila's favorite part of Mami's good days was when Bobby came home, when she and Mami looked up from the board and grinned at him with brown teeth. A gust of contentment puffed through the room then, and Laila caught a momentary glimpse of the tenderness, the romance that had once bound her parents back when this house had been crowded and noisy and cheerful. Mami sometimes baked on her good days and invited neighborhood women over for tea and pastries. Laila got to lick the bowls clean as Mami set the table with cups and napkins and the good plates. Later, Laila would take her place at the living room table and try to break into the conversation as the women talked boisterously and drank tea and complimented Mami on her baking. Though there was never much for her to say, Laila liked to sit and listen in because at these gatherings she was treated to a rare pleasure. She got to hear Mami speaking affectionately about Bobby. What a first-rate teacher he was, Mami said. His students loved him, and not only because he wouldn't beat them with rulers like other teachers did. They respected him, you see, because he respected them. He was marvelous. Mami loved to tell the story of how she'd proposed to him. I was 16, he was 19. Our families lived next door to each other in Panjshir. Oh, I had the crush on him, Hamsheras. I used to climb the wall between our houses, and we'd play in his father's orchard. Hakim was always scared that we'd get caught and that my father would give him a slapping. Your father's going to give me a slapping, he'd always say. He was so cautious, so serious, even then. And then one day I said to him, Cousin, what will it be? Are you going to ask for my hand, or are you going to make me come, Khostegari, to you? I said it just like that. You should have seen the face on him. Mami would slap her palms together as the women and Laila laughed. Listening to Mami tell these stories, Laila knew that there had been a time when Mami always spoke this way about Bobby. A time when her parents did not sleep in separate rooms. Laila wished she hadn't missed out on those times. Inevitably, Mami's proposal story led to matchmaking schemes. When Afghanistan was free from the Soviets and the boys returned home, they would need brides, and so, one by one, the women paraded the neighborhood girls who might or might not be suitable for Ahmad and Noor. Laila always felt excluded when the talk turned to her brothers, as though the women were discussing a beloved film that only she hadn't seen. She had been 2 years old when Ahmad and Noor had left Kabul for Panjshir up north to join Commander Ahmad Shah Massoud's forces and fight the jihad. Laila hardly remembered anything at all about them. A shiny Allah pendant around Ahmad's neck, a patch of black hairs on one of Noor's ears, and that was it. What about Azita? The rugmaker's daughter? Mami said, slapping her cheek with mock outrage. She has a thicker mustache than Hakim. There's Honoreta. We hear she's top in her class at Zarhuna. Have you seen the teeth on that girl? Tombstones. She's hiding a graveyard behind those lips. How about the Vahidi sisters? Those two dwarves? No, no, no. Oh, no. Not for my sons. Not for my sultans. They deserve better. As the chatter went on, Layla let her mind drift. And as always, it found Tariq. Mummy had pulled the yellowish curtains. In the darkness, the room had a layered smell about it. Sleep, unwashed linen, sweat, dirty socks, perfume. The previous night's leftover korma. Layla waited for her eyes to adjust before she crossed the room. Even so, her feet became entangled with items of clothing that littered the floor. Layla pulled the curtains open. At the foot of the bed was an old metallic folding chair. Layla sat on it and watched the unmoving blanketed mound that was her mother. The walls of Mummy's room were covered with pictures of Ahmad and Noor. Everywhere Layla looked, two strangers smiled back. Here was Noor mounting a tricycle. Here was Ahmad doing his prayers, posing beside a sundial Bobby and he had built when he was 12. And there they were, her brothers, sitting back to back beneath the old pear tree in the yard. Beneath Mummy's bed, Layla could see the corner of Ahmad's shoebox protruding. From time to time, Mummy showed her the old crumpled newspaper clippings in it and pamphlets that Ahmad had managed to collect from insurgent groups and resistance organizations headquartered in Pakistan. One photo, Layla remembered, showed a man in a long white coat handing a lollipop to a legless little boy. The caption below the photo read, "Children are the intended victims of Soviet landmine campaign." The article went on to say that the Soviets also like to hide explosives inside brightly colored toys. If a child picked it up, the toy exploded, tore off fingers, or an entire hand. The father could not join the jihad then. He'd have to stay home and care for his child. In another article, in Ahmad's box, a young mujahid was saying that the Soviets had dropped gas on his village that burned people's skin and blinded them. He said he had seen his mother and sister running for the stream, coughing up blood. "Mummy!" The mound stirred slightly. It emitted a groan. "Get up, Mummy! It's 3 o'clock!" Another groan. A hand emerged like a submarine periscope, breaking surface, and dropped. The mount moved more discernibly this time. Then the rustle of blankets, as layers of them shifted over each other. Slowly, in stages, Mami materialized, first the slovenly hair, then the white, grimacing face, eyes pinched shut against the light, a hand groping for the headboard, the sheet sliding down as she pulled herself up, grunting. Mami made an effort to look up, flinched against the light, and her head drooped over her chest. "How was school?" she muttered. So it would begin. The obligatory questions, the perfunctory answers, both pretending. Unenthusiastic partners, the two of them, in this tired old dance. "School was fine," Layla said.
"Did you learn anything?"
"The usual."
"Did you eat?"
"I did."
"Good."
Mummy raised her head again, toward the window. She winced and her eyelids fluttered. The right side of her face was red, and the hair on that side had flattened. "I have a headache. Should I fetch you some aspirin?" Mummy massaged her temples. "Maybe later. Is your father home?"
"It's only 3.
"Oh, right. You said that already." Mummy yawned.
"I was dreaming just now," she said, her voice only a bit louder than the rustle of her nightgown against the sheets. "Just now before you came in, but I can't remember it now. Does that happen to you?"
"It happens to everybody, Mummy."
"Strangest thing." I should tell you that while you were dreaming, a boy shot piss out of a water gun on my hair.
Shot what?
What was that? I'm sorry. Piss. Urine.
That's terrible. God, I'm sorry. Poor you.
I'll have a talk with him first thing in the morning. Or maybe with his mother. Yes, that would be better, I think.
I haven't told you who it was.
Oh, well, who was it?
Never mind.
You're angry.
You were supposed to pick me up.
I was, Mummy croaked. Lila could not tell whether this was a question. Mummy began picking at her hair. This was one of life's great mysteries to Lila, that Mummy's picking had not made her bald as an egg.
What about, what's his name, your friend Tariq?
Yes, what about him?
He's been gone for a week.
Oh. Mummy sighed through her nose.
Did you wash?
Yes.
So you're clean then?
Mummy turned her tired gaze to the window.
You're clean and everything is fine.
Lila stood up. I have homework now.
Of course you do. Shut the curtains before you go, my love. Mummy said, her voice fading.
She was already sinking beneath the sheets.
As Lila reached for the curtains, she saw a car pass by on the street, tailed by a cloud of dust. It was the blue Benz with the Herat license plate finally leaving. She followed it with her eyes until it vanished around a turn, its back window twinkling in the sun.
I won't forget tomorrow, Mummy was saying behind her. I promise.
You said that yesterday.
You don't know, Lila.
Know what?
Lila wheeled around to face her mother.
What don't I know?
Mummy's hand floated up to her chest, tapped there.
In here. What's in here?
Then it fell flaccid. You just don't know.
A week passed, but there was still no sign of Tariq. Then another week came and went. To fill the time, Lila fixed the screen door that Bobby still hadn't got around to. She took down Bobby's books, dusted and alphabetized them. She went to Chicken Street with Hasina, Giti, and Giti's mother, Nila, who was a seamstress and sometimes sewing partner of Mami's. In that week, Lila came to believe that of all the hardships a person had to face, none was more punishing than the simple act of waiting. Another week passed. Lila found herself caught in a net of terrible thoughts. He would never come back. His parents had moved away for good. The trip to Ghazni had been a ruse, an adult scheme to spare the two of them an upsetting farewell. A landmine had gotten to him again, the way it did in 1981, when he was 5, the last time his parents took him south to Ghazni. That was shortly after Lila's 3rd birthday. He'd been lucky that time, losing only a leg. Lucky that he'd survived at all. Her head rang and rang with these thoughts. Then one night, Lila saw a tiny flashing light from down the street. A sound, something between a squeak and a gasp, escaped her lips. She quickly fished her own flashlight from under the bed, but it wouldn't work. Lila banged it against her palm, cursed the dead batteries. But it didn't matter. He was back. Lila sat on the edge of her bed, giddy with relief, and watched that beautiful yellow eye winking on and off. On her way to Tariq's house the next day, Lila saw Khadim and a group of his friends across the street. Khadim was squatting, drawing something in the dirt with a stick. When he saw her, he dropped the stick and wiggled his fingers. He said something, and there was a round of chuckles. Lila dropped her head and hurried past.
What did you do?
She exclaimed when Tariq opened the door. Only then did she remember that his uncle was a barber. Tariq ran his hand over his newly shaved scalp and smiled, showing white, slightly uneven teeth. Like it?
You look like you're enlisting in the army. You want to feel?
He lowered his head. The tiny bristles scratched Lila's palm pleasantly. Tariq wasn't like some of the other boys, whose hair concealed cone-shaped skulls and unsightly lumps. Tariq's head was perfectly curved and lump-free. When he looked up, Laila saw that his cheeks and brow had sunburned. "What took you so long?" she said. "My uncle was sick. Come on, come inside." He led her down the hallway to the family room. Laila loved everything about this house. The shabby old rug in the family room, the patchwork quilt on the couch, the ordinary clutter of Tariq's life, his mother's bolts of fabric, her sewing needles embedded in spools, the old magazines, the accordion case in the corner waiting to be cracked open. "Who is it?" It was his mother calling from the kitchen. "Laila," he answered. He pulled her a chair. The family room was brightly lit and had double windows that opened into the yard. On the sill were empty jars in which Tariq's mother pickled eggplant and made carrot marmalade. "You mean our Oros, our daughter-in-law?" his father announced, entering the room. He was a carpenter, a lean, white-haired man in his early 60s. He had gaps between his front teeth and the squinty eyes of someone who had spent most of his life outdoors. He opened his arms and Laila went into them, greeted by his pleasant and familiar smell of sawdust. They kissed on the cheek 3 times. "You keep calling her that and she'll stop coming here," Tariq's mother said, passing by them. She was carrying a tray with a large bowl, a serving spoon, and 4 smaller bowls on it. She set the tray on the table. "Don't mind the old man." She cupped Laila's face. "It's good to see you, my dear. Come, sit down. I brought back some water-soaked fruit with me." The table was bulky and made of a light, unfinished wood. Tariq's father had built it, as well as the chairs. It was covered with a moss-green vinyl tablecloth with little magenta crescents and stars on it. Most of the living room wall was taken up with pictures of Tariq at various ages. In some of the very early ones, he had 2 legs. "I heard your brother was sick," Laila said to Tariq's father, dipping a spoon into her bowl of soaked raisins, pistachios, and apricots. He was lighting a cigarette. "Yes, but he's fine now, shukri khuda, thanks to God." "Heart attack, his second," Tariq's mother said, giving her husband an admonishing look. Tariq's father blew smoke and winked at Laila. It struck her again that Tariq's parents could easily pass for his grandparents. His mother hadn't had him until she'd been well into her 40s. "How is your father, my dear?" Tariq's mother said, looking on over her bowl. As long as Laila had known her, Tariq's mother had worn a wig. It was turning a dull purple with age. It was pulled low on her brow today, and Laila could see the gray hairs of her sideburns. Some days it rode high on her forehead. But to Laila, Tariq's mother never looked pitiable in it. What Laila saw was the calm, self-assured face beneath the wig, the clever eyes, the pleasant, unhurried manners. "He's fine," Laila said. "Still at Silo, of course. He's fine." "And your mother?" "Good days, bad ones too, the same." "Yes," Tariq's mother said thoughtfully, lowering her spoon into the bowl. "How hard it must be, how terribly hard for a mother to be away from her sons." "You're staying for lunch?" Tariq said. "You have to," said his mother. "I'm making shorwa." "I don't want to be muzaim." "Imposing?" Tariq's mother said. "We leave for a couple of weeks and you turn polite on us?" "All right, I'll stay," Laila said, blushing and smiling. "It's settled then." The truth was, Laila loved eating meals at Tariq's house as much as she disliked eating them at hers. At Tariq's, there was no eating alone. They always ate as a family. Laila liked the violet plastic drinking glasses they used and the quarter lemon that always floated in the water pitcher. She liked how they started each meal with a bowl of fresh yogurt, how they squeezed sour oranges on everything, even their yogurt, and how they made small, harmless jokes at each other's expense. Over meals, conversation always flowed. Though Tariq and his parents were ethnic Pashtuns, They spoke Farsi when Laila was around, for her benefit, even though Laila more or less understood their native Pashto, having learned it in school. Bobby said that there were tensions between their people, the Tajiks, who were a minority, and Tariq's people, the Pashtuns, who were the largest ethnic group in Afghanistan. Tajiks have always felt slighted, Bobby had said. Pashtun kings ruled this country for almost 250 years, Laila, and Tajiks for all of 9 months, back in 1929. And you? Laila had asked. Do you feel slighted, Bobby? Bobby had wiped his eyeglasses clean with the hem of his shirt. To me, it's nonsense, and very dangerous nonsense at that. All this talk of I'm Tajik, and you're Pashtun, and he's Hazara, and she's Uzbek. We're all Afghans, and that's all that should matter. But when one group rules over the others for so long, there's contempt, rivalry. There is. There always has been. Maybe so, but Laila never felt it in Tariq's house, where these matters never even came up. Her time with Tariq's family always felt natural to Laila, effortless, uncomplicated by differences in tribe or language, or by the personal spites and grudges that infected the air at her own home. How about a game of cards? Tariq said. Yes, go upstairs, his mother said, swiping disapprovingly at her husband's cloud of smoke. I'll get the shorwa going. They lay on their stomachs in the middle of Tariq's room and took turns dealing for panjpar. Pedaling air with his foot, Tariq told her about his trip. The peach saplings he had helped his uncle plant. A garden snake he had captured. This room was where Laila and Tariq did their homework, where they built playing card towers and drew ridiculous portraits of each other. If it was raining, they leaned on the windowsill, drinking warm, fizzy orange Fanta, and watched the swollen rain droplets trickle down the glass. All right, here's one, Laila said, shuffling. What goes around the world but stays in a corner? Wait. Tariq pushed himself up and swung his artificial left leg around. Wincing, he lay on his side, leaning on his elbow. Hand me that pillow. He placed it under his leg. There, that's better. Laila remembered the first time he'd shown her a stump. She'd been six. With one finger, she had poked the taut, shiny skin just below his left knee. Her finger had found little hard lumps there, and Tariq had told her they were spurs of bone that sometimes grew after an amputation. She'd asked him if his stump hurt, and he said it got sore at the end of the day, when it swelled and didn't fit the prosthesis like it was supposed to, like a finger in a thimble. And sometimes it gets rubbed, especially when it's hot. Then I get rashes and blisters, but my mother has creams that help. It's not so bad. Laila had burst into tears. What are you crying for? He'd strapped his leg back on. You asked to see it, Yogeri Anok, you crybaby. If I'd known you were going to ball, I wouldn't have shown you. A stamp, he said. What? The riddle. The answer's a stamp. We should go to the zoo after lunch. You knew that one, did you? Absolutely not. You're a cheat. And you're envious. Of what? My masculine smarts. Your masculine smarts? Really? Tell me who always wins at chess. I let you win. He laughed. They both knew that wasn't true. And who failed math? Who do you come to for help with your math homework, even though you're a grade ahead? I'd be two grades ahead if math didn't bore me. I suppose geography bores you too. How did you know? Now shut up. So are we going to the zoo or not? Laila smiled. We're going. Good. I missed you. There was a pause. Then Tariq turned to her with a half-grinning, half-grimacing look of distaste. What's the matter with you? How many times had she, Hasina, and Giti said those same three words to each other? Laila wondered, said it without hesitation, after only 2 or 3 days of not seeing each other. I missed you, Hasina. Oh, I missed you too. In Tariq's grimace, Lila learned that boys differed from girls in this regard. They didn't make a show of friendship. They felt no urge, no need for this sort of talk. Lila imagined it had been this way for her brothers, too. Boys, Lila came to see, treated friendship the way they treated the sun, its existence undisputed, its radiance best enjoyed, not beheld directly. "I was trying to annoy you," she said. He gave her a sidelong glance. It worked. But she thought his grimace softened, and she thought that maybe the sunburn on his cheeks deepened momentarily. Lila didn't mean to tell him. She'd in fact decided that telling him would be a very bad idea. Someone would get hurt because Tariq wouldn't be able to let it pass. But when they were on the street later, heading down to the bus stop, she saw Khadim again, leaning against the wall. He was surrounded by his friends, thumbs hooked in his belt loops. He grinned at her defiantly. And so she told Tariq. The story spilled out of her mouth before she could stop it. "He did what?" She told him again. He pointed to Khadim. "Him? He's the one? You sure?" "I'm sure." Tariq clenched his teeth and muttered something to himself in Pashto that Lila didn't catch. "You wait here," he said, in Farsi now. "No, Tariq." He was already crossing the street. Khadim was the first to see him. His grin faded, and he pushed himself off the wall. He unhooked his thumbs from the belt loops and made himself more upright, taking on a self-conscious air of menace. The others followed his gaze. Lila wished she hadn't said anything. What if they banded together? How many of them were there? 10, 11, 12? What if they hurt him? Then Tariq stopped a few feet from Khadim and his band. There was a moment of consideration, Lila thought, maybe a change of heart. And, when he bent down, she imagined he would pretend his shoelace had come undone and walk back to her. Then his hands went to work, and she understood. The others understood, too, when Tariq straightened up, standing on one leg, when he began hopping toward Khadim, then charging him, his unstrapped leg raised high over his shoulder like a sword. The boys stepped aside in a hurry. They gave him a clear path to Khadim. Then it was all dust and fists and kicks and yelps. Khadim never bothered Lila again. That night, as most nights, Lila set the dinner table for two only. Mummy said she wasn't hungry. On those nights that she was, she made a point of taking a plate to her room before Bobby even came home. She was usually asleep or lying awake in bed by the time Lila and Bobby sat down to eat. Bobby came out of the bathroom, his hair, peppered white with flour when he'd come home, washed clean now and combed back. "What are we having, Lila?" "Leftover Arsh soup." "Sounds good," he said, folding the towel with which he had dried his hair. "So what are we working on tonight? Adding fractions?" "Actually, converting fractions to mixed numbers." "Ah, right." Every night after dinner, Bobby helped Lila with her homework and gave her some of his own. This was only to keep Lila a step or two ahead of her class, not because he disapproved of the work assigned by the school, the propaganda teaching notwithstanding. In fact, Bobby thought that the one thing the communists had done right, or at least intended to, ironically, was in the field of education, the vocation from which they had fired him. More specifically, the education of women. The government had sponsored literacy classes for all women. Almost two-thirds of students at Kabul University were women now, Bobby said, women who were studying law, medicine, engineering. "Women have always had it hard in this country, Lila, but they're probably more free now under the communists and have more rights than they've ever had before," Bobby said, always lowering his voice, aware of how intolerant Mami was of even remotely positive talk of the communists. "But it's true," Bobby said. "It's a good time to be a woman in Afghanistan. And you can take advantage of that, Lila. Of course, women's freedom..." Here he shook his head ruefully. "Is also one of the reasons people out there took up arms in the first place." By out there, he didn't mean Kabul, which had always been relatively liberal and progressive. Here in Kabul, women taught at the university, ran schools, held office in the government. No, Bobby meant the tribal areas, especially the Pashtun regions in the south or in the east, near the Pakistani border, where women were rarely seen on the streets, and only then in burqa and accompanied by men. He meant those regions where men who lived by ancient tribal laws had rebelled against the communists and their decrees to liberate women, to abolish forced marriage, to raise the minimum marriage age to 16 for girls. There, men saw it as an insult to their centuries-old tradition, Bobby said, to be told by the government, and a godless one at that, that their daughters had to leave home, attend school, and work alongside men. God forbid that should happen, Bobby liked to say sarcastically. Then he would sigh and say, Laila, my love, the only enemy an Afghan cannot defeat is himself. Bobby took his seat at the table, dipped bread into his bowl of ash. Laila decided that she would tell him about what Tariq had done to Khadim over the meal before they started in on fractions. But she never got the chance, because right then there was a knock at the door, and on the other side of the door, a stranger with news. I need to speak to your parents, Dukhtarjan, he said when Laila opened the door. He was a stocky man with a sharp, weather-roughened face. He wore a potato-colored coat and a brown wool pakol on his head. Can I tell them who's here? Then Bobby's hand was on Laila's shoulder and he gently pulled her from the door. Why don't you go upstairs, Laila? Go on. As she moved toward the steps, Laila heard the visitor say to Bobby that he had news from Pancher. Mummy was in the room now, too. She had one hand clamped over her mouth, and her eyes were skipping from Bobby to the man in the pakol. Laila peeked from the top of the stairs. She watched the stranger sit down with her parents. He leaned toward them, said a few muted words. Then Bobby's face was white and getting whiter, and he was looking at his hands, and Mummy was screaming, screaming and tearing at her hair. The next morning, the day of the fatia, a flock of neighborhood women descended on the house and took charge of preparations for the khatim dinner that would take place after the funeral. Mummy sat on the couch the whole morning, her fingers working a handkerchief, her face bloated. She was tended to by a pair of sniffling women who took turns patting Mummy's hand gingerly, like she was the rarest and most fragile doll in the world. Mummy did not seem aware of their presence. Laila kneeled before her mother and took her hands. Mummy? Mummy's eyes drifted down. She blinked. We'll take care of her, Laila John, one of the women said with an air of self-importance. Laila had been to funerals before, where she had seen women like this, women who relished all things that had to do with death, official consolers who let no one trespass on their self-appointed duties. It's under control. You go on now, girl, and do something else. Leave your mother be. Shooed away, Laila felt useless. She bounced from one room to the next. She puttered around the kitchen for a while. An uncharacteristically subdued Hasina and her mother came. So did Giti and her mother. When Giti saw Laila, she hurried over, threw her bony arms around her, and gave Laila a very long and surprisingly strong embrace. When she pulled back, tears had pooled in her eyes. I'm so sorry, Laila, she said. Laila thanked her. The three girls sat outside in the yard until one of the women assigned them the task of washing glasses and stacking plates on the table. Bobby, too, kept walking in and out of the house aimlessly, looking, it seemed, for something to do. Keep him away from me. That was the only time Mummy said anything, all morning. Bobby ended up sitting alone in a folding chair in the hallway, looking desolate and small. Then one of the women told him he was in the way there. He apologized and disappeared into his study. That afternoon, the men went to a hall in Kartese that Bobby had rented for the fatia. The women came to the house. Laila took her spot beside Mami, next to the living room entrance, where it was customary for the family of the deceased to sit. Mourners removed their shoes at the door, nodded at acquaintances as they crossed the room, and sat on folding chairs arranged along the walls. Laila saw Wajma, the elderly midwife who had delivered her. She saw Tariq's mother, too, wearing a black scarf over the wig. She gave Laila a nod and a slow, sad, close-lipped smile. From a cassette player, a man's nasal voice chanted verses from the Quran. In between, the women sighed and shifted and sniffled. There were muted coughs, murmurs, and, periodically, someone let out a theatrical, sorrow-drenched sob. Rashid's wife, Mariam, came in. She was wearing a black hijab, strands of her hair strayed from it onto her brow. She took a seat along the wall across from Laila. Next to Laila, Mami kept rocking back and forth. Laila drew Mami's hand into her lap and cradled it with both of hers, but Mami did not seem to notice. "Do you want some water, Mami?" Laila said in her ear. "Are you thirsty?" But Mami said nothing. She did nothing but sway back and forth and stare at the rug with a remote, spiritless look. Now and then, sitting next to Mami, seeing the drooping, woebegone looks around the room, the magnitude of the disaster that had struck her family would register with Laila. The possibilities denied, the hopes dashed. But the feeling didn't last. It was hard to feel, really feel, Mami's loss. Hard to summon sorrow, to grieve the death of people Laila had never really thought of as alive in the first place. Ahmad and Noor had always been like lore to her, like characters in a fable, kings in a history book. It was Tariq who was real, flesh and blood. Tariq who taught her cuss words in Pashto, who liked salted clover leaves, who frowned and made a low, moaning sound when he chewed, who had a light pink birthmark just beneath his left collarbone, shaped like an upside-down mandolin. So she sat beside Mami and dutifully mourned Ahmad and Noor. But in Laila's heart, her true brother was alive and well. The ailments that would hound Mami for the rest of her days began. Chest pains and headaches, joint aches and night sweats, paralyzing pains in her ears, lumps no one else could feel. Bobby took her to a doctor who took blood and urine, shot x-rays of Mami's body, but found no physical illness. Mami lay in bed most days. She wore black. She picked at her hair and gnawed on the mole below her lip. When Mami was awake, Laila found her staggering through the house. She always ended up in Laila's room, as though she would run into the boys sooner or later if she just kept walking into the room where they had once slept and farted and fought with pillows. But all she ran into was their absence. And Laila, which Laila believed had become one and the same to Mami. The only task Mami never neglected was her 5 daily namaz prayers. She ended each namaz with her head hung low, hands held before her face, palms up, muttering a prayer for God to bring victory to the Mujahideen. Laila had to shoulder more and more of the chores. If she didn't tend to the house, she was apt to find clothes, shoes, open rice bags, cans of beans, and dirty dishes strewn about everywhere. Laila washed Mami's dresses and changed her sheets. She coaxed her out of bed for baths and meals. She was the one who ironed Bobby's shirts and folded his pants. Increasingly, she was the cook. Sometimes, after she was done with her chores, Laila crawled into bed next to Mami. She wrapped her arms around her, laced her fingers with her mother's, buried her face in her hair. Mami would stir, murmur something. Inevitably, she would start in on a story about the boys. One day, as they were lying this way, Mami said, "Ahmad was going to be a leader. He had the charisma for it. People 3 times his age listened to him with respect, Laila. It was something to see. And Noor, oh my Noor. He was always making sketches of buildings and bridges. He was going to be an architect, you know? He was going to transform Kabul with his designs. And now they're both Shahid, my boys, both martyrs." Lila lay there and listened, wishing Mummy would notice that she, Lila, hadn't become Shahid, that she was alive, here, in bed with her, that she had hopes and a future. But Lila knew that her future was no match for her brother's past. They had overshadowed her in life. They would obliterate her in death. Mummy was now the curator of their lives' museum, and she, Lila, a mere visitor, a receptacle for their myths, the parchment on which Mummy meant to ink their legends. The messenger who came with the news, he said that when they brought the boys back to camp, Ahmad Shah Massoud personally oversaw the burial. He said a prayer for them at the gravesite. That's the kind of brave young men your brothers were, Lila, that Commander Massoud himself, the Lion of Panjshir, God bless him, would oversee their burial. Mummy rolled onto her back. Lila shifted, rested her head on Mummy's chest. Some days, Mummy said in a hoarse voice, I listen to that clock ticking in the hallway. Then I think of all the ticks, all the minutes, all the hours and days and weeks and months and years waiting for me. All of it without them. And I can't breathe then. Like someone stepping on my heart, Lila. I get so weak. So weak, I just want to collapse somewhere. I wish there was something I could do, Lila said, meaning it. But it came out sounding broad, perfunctory, like the token consolation of a kind stranger. You're a good daughter, Mummy said after a deep sigh. And I haven't been much of a mother to you. Don't say that. Oh, it's true. I know it, and I'm sorry for it, my love. Mummy? Lila sat up, looking down at Mummy. There were gray strands in Mummy's hair now, and it startled Lila how much weight Mummy, who'd always been plump, had lost. Her cheeks had a sallow, drawn look. The blouse she was wearing drooped over her shoulders, and there was a gaping space between her neck and the collar. More than once, Lila had seen the wedding band slide off Mummy's finger. I've been meaning to ask you something. What is it? You wouldn't, Lila began. She talked about it to Hasina. At Hasina's suggestion, the two of them had emptied the bottle of aspirin in the gutter, hidden the kitchen knives and the sharp kebab skewers beneath the rug under the couch. Hasina had found a rope in the yard. When Bobby couldn't find his razors, Lila had to tell him of her fears. He dropped on the edge of the couch, hands between his knees. Lila waited for some kind of reassurance from him. But all she got was a bewildered, hollow-eyed look. You wouldn't... Mummy, I worry that... I thought about it the night we got the news, Mummy said. I won't lie to you. I've thought about it since, too. But no. Don't worry, Lila. I want to see my son's dream come true. I want to see the day the Soviets go home disgraced. The day the Mujahideen come to Kabul in victory. I want to be there when it happens, when Afghanistan is free, so the boys see it too. They'll see it through my eyes. Mummy was soon asleep, leaving Lila with dueling emotions, reassured that Mummy meant to live on, stung that she was not the reason. She would never leave a mark on Mummy's heart the way her brothers had, because Mummy's heart was like a pallid beach where Lila's footprints would forever wash away beneath the waves of sorrow that swelled and crashed, swelled and crashed. The driver pulled his taxi over to let pass another long convoy of Soviet jeeps and armored vehicles. Tariq leaned across the front seat over the driver and yelled, Payalista! Payalista! A jeep honked and Tariq whistled back, beaming and waving cheerfully. Lovely guns, he yelled. Fabulous jeeps! Fabulous army! Too bad you're losing to a bunch of peasants firing slingshots! The convoy passed. The driver merged back onto the road. How much farther? Lila asked. An hour at the most, the driver said. Barring any more convoys or checkpoints. They were taking a day trip, Lila, Bobby, and Tariq. Hasina had wanted to come too, had begged her father, but he wouldn't allow it. The trip was Bobby's idea. Though he could hardly afford it on his salary, he'd hired a driver for the day. He wouldn't disclose anything to Layla about their destination, except to say that, with it, he was contributing to her education. They had been on the road since 5 in the morning. Through Layla's window, the landscape shifted from snow-capped peaks to deserts to canyons and sun-scorched outcroppings of rocks. Along the way, they passed mud houses with thatched roofs and fields dotted with bundles of wheat. Pitched out in the dusty fields, here and there, Layla recognized the black tents of Kuchi nomads, and, frequently, the carcasses of burned-out Soviet tanks and wrecked helicopters. This, she thought, was Ahmad and Nur's Afghanistan. This, here in the provinces, was where the war was being fought after all. Not in Kabul. Kabul was largely at peace. Back in Kabul, if not for the occasional bursts of gunfire, if not for the Soviet soldiers smoking on the sidewalks and the Soviet jeeps always bumping through the streets, war might as well have been a rumor. It was late morning, after they'd passed 2 more checkpoints, when they entered a valley. Bobby had Layla lean across the seat and pointed to a series of ancient-looking walls of sun-dried red in the distance. That's called Shar-e-Zoak, the Red City. It used to be a fortress. It was built some 900 years ago to defend the valley from invaders. Genghis Khan's grandson attacked it in the 13th century, but he was killed. It was Genghis Khan himself who then destroyed it. And that, my young friends, is the story of our country, one invader after another, the driver said, flicking cigarette ash out the window. Macedonians, Sasanians, Arabs, Mongols, now the Soviets. But we're like those walls up there, battered and nothing pretty to look at, but still standing. Isn't that the truth, Badar? Indeed it is, said Bobby. Half an hour later, the driver pulled over. Come on, you two, Bobby said. Come outside and have a look. They got out of the taxi. Bobby pointed. There they are. Look. Tariq gasped. Layla did too. And she knew then that she could live to be 100, and she would never again see a thing as magnificent. The 2 Buddhas were enormous, soaring much higher than she had imagined from all the photos she'd seen of them. Chiseled into a sun-bleached rock cliff, they peered down at them, as they had nearly 2,000 years before, Layla imagined, at caravans crossing the valley on the Silk Road. On either side of them, along the overhanging niche, the cliff was pocked with myriad caves. I feel so small, Tariq said. You want to climb up? Bobby said. Up the statues? Layla asked. We can do that? Bobby smiled and held out his hand. Come on. The climb was hard for Tariq, who had to hold on to both Layla and Bobby as they inched up a winding, narrow, dimly lit staircase. They saw shadowy caves along the way and tunnels honeycombing the cliff every which way. Careful where you step, Bobby said. His voice made a loud echo. The ground is treacherous. In some parts, the staircase was open to the Buddha's cavity. Don't look down, children. Keep looking straight ahead. As they climbed, Bobby told them that Bamiyan had once been a thriving Buddhist center until it had fallen under Islamic Arab rule in the 9th century. The sandstone cliffs were home to Buddhist monks who carved caves in them to use as living quarters and a sanctuary for weary traveling pilgrims. The monks, Bobby said, painted beautiful frescoes along the walls and roofs of their caves. At one point, he said, there were 5,000 monks living as hermits in these caves. Tariq was badly out of breath when they reached the top. Bobby was panting too, but his eyes shone with excitement. We're standing atop its head, he said, wiping his brow with a handkerchief. There's a niche over here where we can look out. They inched over to the craggy overhang and, standing side by side, with Bobby in the middle, gazed down on the valley. Look at this, said Lila. Bobby smiled. The Bamyan Valley below was carpeted by lush farming fields. Bobby said there were green winter wheat and alfalfa, potatoes too. The fields were bordered by poplars and crisscrossed by streams and irrigation ditches, on the banks of which tiny female figures squatted and washed clothes. Bobby pointed to rice paddies and barley fields draping the slopes. It was autumn, and Lila could make out people in bright tunics on the roofs of mud-brick dwellings laying out the harvest to dry. The main road going through the town was poplar-lined, too. There were small shops and tea houses and street-side barbers on either side of it. Beyond the village, beyond the river and the streams, Lila saw foothills, bare and dusty brown, and beyond those, as beyond everything else in Afghanistan, the snow-capped Hindu Kush. The sky above all of this was an immaculate, spotless blue. "It's so quiet," Lila breathed. She could see tiny sheep and horses, but couldn't hear their bleating and whinnying. "It's what I always remember about being up here," Bobby said. "The silence, the peace of it. I wanted you to experience it. But I also wanted you to see your country's heritage, children, to learn of its rich past. You see, some things I can teach you, some you learn from books, but there are things that, well, you just have to see and feel." "Look," said Tariq. They watched a hawk gliding in circles above the village. "Did you ever bring Mami up here?" Lila asked. "Oh, many times. Before the boys were born. After, too. Your mother, she used to be adventurous then, and so alive. She was just about the liveliest, happiest person I'd ever met." He smiled at the memory. "She had this laugh. I swear it's why I married her, Lila, for that laugh. It bulldozed you. You stood no chance against it." A wave of affection overcame Lila. From then on, she would always remember Bobby this way, reminiscing about Mami, with his elbows on the rock, hands cupping his chin, his hair ruffled by the wind, eyes crinkled against the sun. "I'm going to look at some of those caves," Tariq said. "Be careful," said Bobby. "I will, Kakajan," Tariq's voice echoed back. Lila watched a trio of men far below, talking near a cow tethered to a fence. Around them, the trees had started to turn, ochre and orange, scarlet red. "I miss the boys too, you know," Bobby said. His eyes had welled up a tad. His chin was trembling. "I may not. With your mother, both her joy and sadness are extreme. She can't hide either. She never could. Me, I suppose, I'm different. I tend to. But it broke me too, the boys dying. I miss them too. Not a day passes that I. It's very hard, Lila. So very hard." He squeezed the inner corners of his eyes with his thumb and forefinger. When he tried to talk, his voice broke. He pulled his lips over his teeth and waited. He took a long, deep breath, looked at her. "But I'm glad I have you. Every day I thank God for you. Every single day. Sometimes when your mother's having one of her really dark days, I feel like you're all I have, Lila." Lila drew closer to him and rested her cheek up against his chest. He seemed slightly startled. Unlike Mami, he rarely expressed his affection physically. He planted a brisk kiss on the top of her head and hugged her back awkwardly. They stood this way for a while, looking down on the Bamyan Valley. "As much as I love this land, some days I think about leaving it," Bobby said. "Where to?" "Any place where it's easy to forget. Pakistan first, I suppose. For a year, maybe two. Wait for our paperwork to get processed." "And then?" "And then, well, it is a big world. Maybe America. Somewhere near the sea, like California." Bobby said the Americans were a generous people. They would help them with money and food for a while, until they could get on their feet. "I would find work, and, in a few years, when we had enough saved up, we'd open a little Afron restaurant. Nothing fancy, mind you, just a modest little place